It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Saturday, February 18th, 2023. I'm Ryan Schmelz. Former UN Ambassador and South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley has officially entered the race for president. What are her chances as she goes up against her former boss, Donald Trump?
Someone will emerge as a Trump alternative. And obviously, if there's more than one and that vote is split, that almost assures the fact that Donald Trump will win the Republican nomination.
I'm Chad Pergra. Members of Congress were briefed this week on 3 unidentified flying objects that were shot down over North American airspace. It's looking like a cruel summer in Washington. Debt ceiling gets hotter and hotter.
If we haven't shot anything over U.S. domestic territory, at least the mainland, in some 65 years, I think we need to hear from the administration. What are we doing and why are we doing it?
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
While governor of South Carolina, Nikki Haley's profile grew after delivering the Republican response to then-President Barack Obama's State of the Union address. She'd be selected as President Donald Trump's ambassador to the United Nations, despite criticizing him on the campaign trail and endorsing Republican rivals Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. It's a long resume for the 51-year-old daughter of Indian immigrants, who's now trying to become the first woman elected president of the United States. But first, can she win a primary that already includes former President Trump?
Get in now while nobody else is in. And Trump has obviously already been in for a while, but isn't really generating a lot of news. And so she kind of had the stage all to herself. And I think she capitalized on that.
Real Clear Politics co-founder and president Tom Bevin joins us to discuss.
It was smart strategically for her to, the news cycle moved so fast, and I'm afraid that, you know, so she got her, you know, time, but it'll be, I think the media is going to be moving on here pretty quickly to something else, and she's going to have to find a way to stay relevant in this race for a long, long time. And that's the other decision that some of these candidates are making. I mean, you want to get in the race late enough so that you're still the fresh face, the new thing, because you don't want to get in so early that by the time the voting rolls around and people start paying attention that you're old news, and there are 5 other or 6 other candidates in there that are the new hot thing.
And what do you think she has to do to kind of stay relevant as we kind of see this field continue to grow throughout the year?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And she's going to have to obviously spend a lot of time on the trail. She's going to have good ads, good sound bites. She's going to have to try and figure out a way to, you know, penetrate the noise of the news, if you will, and not just be part of that background noise. She's going to have to find ways to break through. And, you know, the other thing that I think she missed a bit of an opportunity on is really establishing the rationale for her candidacy. I mean, she mentioned the fact she's a woman. She mentioned the fact that, you know, the Republican Party needs new leadership, sort of taking a shot at Donald Trump. You know, she mentioned the fact that she stands up to bullies like China and Iran. Okay, I guess foreign policy related. But beyond that, it was kind of like, those are thematic. Those are not tactical, strategic, you know, policy decisions and choices that give voters sort of, you know, something to really hold on to. So I think she really has to develop that piece of it, because that certainly was lacking in the initial rollout.
Right. And I feel like when we talk about Nikki Haley and policy, the one that's getting most of the attention, at least that she's kind of running on, is she's kind of running on this cognitive test for members of Congress who were in their mid to late 70s. I've heard this idea floated around before, but this is the first time I've seen a candidate really seize on it. And she's not the first person to go after term limits either. I think that's been run on several times now. But what do you make of running on this cognitive test and actually using it as part of the platform?
I think it'll probably not do as much for her as she thought. Look, I think there is a general sense, and you can craft this in a way that's not considered ageist, but certainly there, I think the American people are open to the idea that, you know, we've got a lot of folks in the Senate. I don't know what the average age is off the top of my head, but it's old. And you have some of these folks like Dianne Feinstein's finally retiring, but you've got some others in the Senate that are very old. And, you know, you listen to some of these folks holding these hearings on like big tech, and they don't even know how any of these platforms work. Some of them don't, you know, they have their staff use emails. I mean, there is a disconnect there between the age of the folks that are in Congress and the problems that they're trying to solve. And I think she could exploit that in a way that people would be attracted to and invest in. But term limits is something that's fairly popular with a lot of folks. It's got some downsides, but by and large, I think the public agrees with that. And as you mentioned, plenty of candidates have run on that before. So, but she could definitely do more to enhance this idea of the new generation and what that would actually look like and entail for voters.
And you know, when we talk about Haley's candidacy, you know, I remember a couple years ago when President Trump was in office, I had some political analysts tell me that, you know, Mike Pence better hope that Nikki Haley's patient, because there's a lot of people who want to see her potentially as president one day, and she would definitely make a strong candidate. Now, fast forward to now, I'm not saying she's not a strong candidate, but it seems like she definitely is not. It doesn't have that position as the number two behind Donald Trump the way she was a couple years ago. And that seems to be taken up by Ron DeSantis. What do you think happened between a few years ago and now where she might not be as talked about as a legitimate candidate as she used to be?
Well, I mean, she's been out of the spotlight for a little bit. And so I think, you know, in terms of the public consciousness, her profile is has sort of receded a little bit. And that'll change as she moves forward. But you know, I think she does have a very complicated relationship with Donald Trump. She was in his administration, and then she was kind of, you know, not tried to distance herself from him. And then she kind of has tried to, I think, walk the tightrope of being sufficiently loyal to Donald Trump while also not being so close to him that it becomes, you know, it becomes a problem. And that's going to be the case with a lot of candidates, that they're going to have to try and thread this needle, particularly as they work through the primary process where they're trying to win over voters, and including some of whom are Donald Trump supporters, maybe not the hardcore ones, but the ones who like Trump's policies, but could do with less, you know, histrionics and the baggage that comes with Donald Trump and all the tweeting and name calling and that sort of thing. So look, one of the interesting questions here, I mean, she's clearly a long shot. Okay, as far as the polls say right now, she's entering this race with a couple of intentions, I think. And there's no doubt, I think everybody who gets in these races thinks that they're up to the job and they have a potential for catching fire and winning. But she is starting, as you mentioned, I mean, she's in fourth place in the polls right now. She's behind Mike Pence. And obviously, you know, Trump's at about 45, 47%. DeSantis is around 30%. And our average, Nikki Haley starts at about 3.5 or 4%. So she's got a long way to go. And obviously there's time, but I think she's also looking at the potential that, you know, if she performs well, if she acquits herself well in the campaign, that she could be a vice presidential pick for either Donald Trump or even Ron DeSantis if he ends up winning. So I think she's got a couple motives in mind, and certainly one of them would be scoring a place on the ticket, but not necessarily at the top.
And do you think she does have that strong appeal as a potential VP if that's going to be an option?
Yeah, I think potentially she does for some of the reasons that we've discussed earlier. I mean, she is clearly, you know, charismatic, and she has the resume. I mean, she's a, you know, two-term governor of a state and, you know, the ambassador to the UN. I mean, she is a very accomplished person. She's an accomplished politician, and, you know, she's young, female. I mean, she's got a lot to recommend her for that position. And so I think anybody who ends up winning, if she doesn't win, if someone else wins, they would be foolish not to, you know, at least give her a look and some consideration for the second spot.
Right. And when you mention that resume, I mean, we're talking about somebody who at just the age of 51 years old has foreign policy experience, as well as, like you just said, governmental experience, two terms as South Carolina's governor. You know, this is kind of the ideal experience you'd want from most presidential candidates. Would you say no?
Yeah. I mean, typically, historically, you know, if you look at the broad scope of history, I mean, governors do very well in presidential races because they have that kind of executive experience, and senators do less well. And obviously congressmen sort of rarely are able to make that leap into the presidential arena. So I think from that perspective, and with the additional experience as UN ambassador, I do think, you know, one of the dividing lines in this, and this is what Trump hit her on immediately, is the whole Ukraine, support for Ukraine. And we're going to see this play out over time in the Republican base. There are plenty of folks in the Republican Party now who are not supportive of interventions abroad. They did appreciate Trump's willingness to start pulling us back from Afghanistan, not getting us into new wars, not getting into those foreign entanglements. Nikki Haley is from sort of the other, I don't want to necessarily call her a neocon, but I mean, I think she is more, you know, support for Ukraine when she talks about, she does have a more, I think, aggressive stance with respect to projecting American force abroad. And I think that's going to be, again, that has support within the Republican Party too. But there are plenty of folks, as I mentioned, in the party who have moved rather dramatically in the opposite direction. And so that's probably one of the dividing lines where she's going to have to figure that out pretty darn quick.
And do you also think she's going to have to kind of figure out quickly, you know, how to address former President Trump and try to separate her from him? You know, she may have made references a couple times in her speeches this week, but, you know, she really hasn't gone after him by name or tried to really divide the two of them or really separate herself and make the argument why her over him right now. Right.
Look, it is a tricky thing to get in the ring with Donald Trump. You don't want to spend 18 months. And this is why Ron DeSantis, I'm sure, is still weighing his options, because he's a young guy. He's got a bright future in the Republican Party. And I know there are plenty of people in his ear right now telling him, you've got to do this to save the Republican Party. We'll give you all the money you need. You know, you must get into this race and you must defeat Donald Trump and turn the page for the Republicans and win back the White House. The problem is, in order to do that, he's going to have to spend, you know, the better part of a year, 16 months, 18 months in a mud wrestling match with Donald Trump. And you can see Trump has already branded him, to sanctimonious and meatball Ron and all these things. I mean, there were plenty of candidates who tried to, you know, walk that line. Last time around, you saw, you know, Marco Rubio went from just trying to avoid any discussion of Trump to engaging with him directly. And, you know, Ted Cruz had this similar situation. It's a tough, tough thing. I expect Nikki Haley will find herself in that same position. She'll try to avoid it as long as possible. She'll try to deflect. But if Trump decides to come after her in a serious, sustained way, you know, to not push back on that, to not engage, makes you look, you know, weak. And it's just not a good situation to be in. So we'll see how it plays out. Maybe he won't attack her because he doesn't think she's a big enough threat to actually go directly at her. But, you know, he went at Carly Fiorina on the debate stage and last time around and in not a very nice way. So she should be braced for, you know, anything and everything with regard to Donald Trump in this primary race.
And what do you make of her decision? You know, she ultimately had said, I believe, numerous times that she would not run if former President Trump decided to throw his hat in the ring. And ultimately, she has not done that. She's now officially a candidate for president. Do you think that's going to have an impact here at all?
No, it's hard to say. I mean, people go back on their pledges all the time for various reasons. People say, I'm only going to run for one term or two terms. And then they end up running for more than that. And it never seems to, you know, voters don't necessarily hold that against them. She'll have to answer for it during the campaign. I'm sure it'll be brought up, the fact that she, you know, said she wouldn't run against him and then she did a 180 and is now running against him. So she'll have to answer for that. I mean, I suspect that, you know, the people who will be most offended by that and most upset by that are Trump voters who were never going to vote for her or anyone other than Donald Trump anyway. So I don't suspect it's going to hurt her that much.
And I think one thing that might work in Nikki Haley's favor here is that, you know, she does represent the third state that's going to be on the Republican presidential calendar here for the primary. You know, and I think back to when John Kasich was able to win Ohio, despite the fact that he was deep below Trump in the delegate count. And yet he was a governor with a high approval rating in his home state and was able to win that state. Do you think that South Carolina plays a factor here where it could work to Haley's favor that she has her home state so early in the contest?
Sure. I mean, that's part of the, you know, the calculus here. I mean, I think if she was, you know, governor of a different state, maybe she wouldn't, you know, you got to look at someone like Kristi Noem. I mean, who's also considered a potential, you know, she doesn't have any of that. I mean, she's got proximity to Iowa, but, you know, Chris Sununu's another guy, governor of New Hampshire, is looking at this race potentially as an alternative to Trump. And I'm sure that, you know, as he's making up his pros and cons, his asset and liability sheet, you know, of what's going on, the fact that New Hampshire is first in the nation is first primary in the nation, I should say, is in the asset column. I mean, there's no question about it. So I think that will come into play and we'll just have to see. I mean, Trump had big support in South Carolina. It's a heavily, you know, it's obviously a very conservative state. And we'll also see if Tim Scott decides to get in this race, what that does in terms of, you know, diluting the hometown effect for those two candidates. I mean, Tim Scott is another guy who's, I think, taking a really hard look at this race. He's dipping his toes in some of the waters out in Iowa and other places. And so, and he would be also, I think, an interesting, you know, candidate, again, probably a long shot, but would bring something different to this race and would complicate Nikki Haley's, you know, early stage strategy.
And would Tim Scott provide more of an issue for somebody like Trump or DeSantis, or would that provide more of an issue for Haley if he were to get in the race?
Well, I think for the reasons we just mentioned, it might present more of a problem for Nikki Haley. I mean, suddenly she's not the only hometown, you know, option in South Carolina. Yeah, I haven't looked at their favorability ratings, but if I had to take a guess, I'd guess that Tim Scott's more well liked in South Carolina than she is, but it's probably pretty close. And so either one of them are going to be a long shot, I think, depending on how this plays out. I think it'll be interesting to see if Ron DeSantis does not get in, who will end up being the Trump alternative and be able to rally whatever percent of the vote that ends up being, whether it's 25 or 35 or 45%, someone will emerge as a Trump alternative. And obviously, if there's more than one and that vote is split, that almost assures the fact that Donald Trump will win the Republican nomination.
All right. And last couple of questions here. You know, in her announcement, she kind of highlighted her upbringing as a daughter of Indian immigrants. And she talked about how the left is claiming that American fundamentals are racist. You know, what do you think of this framing? And I'm certainly this is not the first time she said that, too.
Her story is a good story. I mean, she has, in many ways, a classic American dream story, as she mentioned, daughter of immigrants. And the fact that someone of her background is out there saying, and Tim Scott says the same thing. I mean, one of his best lines is, you know, from, what does he say, from the cotton fields to Congress in two generations or something, to push back against this narrative that the United States is a fundamentally systemically racist place. That is a message that will resonate strongly with Republican voters and you know, potentially even some independents in a general election setting. So I think it's a good part of her message, and she needs to keep highlighting it, and I'm sure she will as often as she can.
And whether or not it's as a presidential candidate or just as an asset to the party, do you think that she really does carry that torch in order to get more women involved in the Republican Party, as well as some more minorities as well?
Sure. I mean, the more diverse the party is, and it's becoming more diverse by the day. I mean, every single election, Republicans are electing more African-American candidates, more Asian candidates, more women. Yeah, sure. The more that people see all of those different faces out on the trail pushing, you know, Republican messages, the better it is for the Republican Party. The trouble for Republicans is, you know, and Democrats have their own fight, and we can talk about that another time. But, you know, will all these folks end up getting behind Donald Trump if he ends up being the nominee? And, you know, what will Nikki Haley do? Will she be out there aggressively campaigning for Donald Trump if he becomes the nominee? And I think the biggest problem for Republicans, quite frankly, is if he doesn't win, you know, and let's just say, for the sake of argument, Nikki Haley wins, right? You know, is Donald Trump going to turn around and endorse her and tell all of his hardcore supporters to go vote for Nikki Haley because it's for the good of the Republican Party? I'm not sure that's how that's going to play out, or yeah, even if it's Ron DeSantis. So I think Republicans, they have an interesting choices to be made. Either way this works out, whether Trump is the nominee, or perhaps even more importantly, if he isn't the nominee. And that's when you're going to see, you know, the Republican Party, whether they're able to unify in a significant way or whether they go into a general election in sort of a fractured setting.
Well, Tom Bevin, the co-founder and president of Real Clear Politics, thank you so much for joining us.
You got it.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
Joining me now is my colleague Aisha Hosni on the other side of Capitol Hill. And Aisha, you've tracked a lot of these briefings that they've had, these closed-door briefings with senators about these air incursions. What have we learned? What have we not learned?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, even though we've had all these classified briefings, Chad, a lot of the information that we're learning from lawmakers that come out of these closed-door briefings is that most of what they're hearing is already out in the public. So, for example, we know that obviously there were three new objects that were shot down in the last recent couple of days. We still don't know what these objects are. We don't know where they come from, who sent them, and what the purpose of these objects were. So we're still calling them objects, and we don't know where they come from. But what we do know is a little bit more about the original Chinese spy balloon. We know that there were some parts that were Western made. We know there were some parts with English writing on them. We know that this spy craft had multiple antennas to collect, geolocate communications. It had solar panels that were huge to be able to power intelligence collection sensors. So that was definitely troubling to find out. But there's still a lot of unanswered questions. And I think that's why we're seeing now this bipartisan effort, right? Democrats and Republicans saying, look, until we figure out more that might be classified, why don't we just declassify the majority of what we're learning and share it directly with the American people? Because as you know, Chad, earlier this week, people were wondering if these were aliens, UFOs. I mean, what are we dealing with here? So when you don't have, when you have this vacuum of information and you don't really tell the American people, you know, what you know so far, then people start to, you know, their ideas get away from them, and they think of all these fantastical ideas. And then you have somebody like the White House press secretary having to stand up on the podium and talk about how, no, these are not aliens, and we can stop talking about that.
Yeah, that was quite a moment when that came from both John Kirby, the National Security Council spokesman, yeah, and Karine Jean-Pierre. Just the idea they had to rule that out. And I should note something I've covered as it pertains to this over the years as well, is that Congress and the federal government generally has gotten more serious about dealing with UFOs, or as they call them now, UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena. In the intelligence authorization bill last year, they mandated reporting and documentation and study by the Pentagon and also the Defense Intelligence Agency, also the rest of the intelligence community, to study this and report back to Congress. And mainly that's because of that hearing last year before the House Intelligence Committee. Mm. But Aisha, was this kind of a wake-up moment both to lawmakers but also to the general public about what the threat might be from China? Granted, we don't know about the origin of all of these objects, but the fact that there's some pretty aggressive stuff that's going on behalf of the Chinese.
Yeah, I think certainly what happened, you know, originally with the Chinese spy balloon, I think that was a big wake-up call. I think some would agree that, you know, being able to actually see it from the ground and to not just have this covered by journalists or lawmakers, but really just being an average American citizen and looking up in the sky and seeing something floating above you and then realizing that it's surveilling, you know, you and your neighbors. I think that was a big wake-up moment. One Republican called it a Sputnik moment. But I think when it comes to all these other things in the sky, and there's a lot of things that we've learned are in the sky. Some people call it space trash, what have you not, weather balloons. I think what's interesting is it's always been there. We're just now sort of like getting more hits because we've sort of widened the parameters of what we're searching for. I think the question that everybody has, and myself included, is what's the policy now, right, for this administration? I think that is the ultimate question for lawmakers on the Hill, is where are we at now? Have we changed our policy when it comes to if we see a foreign object in the sky, we don't know what its intention is, motivation, where is it coming from, but we also don't know if it completely poses a threat to American citizens. What do we do with it? Are we now shooting it out of the sky now? Because we have now three times in a row. So I think that is the question moving forward, and that really has to come from the administration. What's our policy now? Are we shooting things out of the sky?
You know, that's something that Senator Marco Rubio, the Republican from Florida, who's the ranking Republican on the Intelligence Committee, pointed out. He said NORAD, you know, which basically, you know, looks for these types of things around the perimeter of the United States and also Canada to some degree, you know, had not shot anything down in 65 years. And then all of a sudden, within a week's time, you know, that is a remarkable moment in that sense. You know, that's something as well.
I think so.
The other thing that I thought was interesting was, were there questions about apparently the first shot at the object that was over Lake Huron missed? And people pointed out that we spend an awful lot of money on the military and on these weapon systems, and they shot and missed.
Well, I think I agree with you. I think that when you take a step back, they obviously weren't trying to blow it up. You know, I think they wanted to hit it just enough to bring it down so they could collect the debris and figure out what in the heck this is. But they didn't want to blow it up. And for whatever reason, they missed. And yeah, so that's a lot of money down the drain. I think the bigger question is, when you kind of like take a step back and just look at everything that's going on, I think we just need to figure out what these things are. And we can't figure that out until we collect the debris. And according to Senator Kennedy, I thought this was the most interesting thing that came out of the classified briefing this week, was that he said that those remnants are lost. He said that we're having a heck of a time finding them, which the administration has admitted. You know, it's a day-to-day process. We're talking about really rough terrain here, bitterly cold temperatures in Canada, Alaska, and Lake Huron. So it's going to take a while to even find any debris, the payloads. And then I think we just really need to figure out what these things are. And if at the end of the day, it's nothing more than somebody's science project, okay, we could breathe a sigh of relief. But then there's a lot of questions. Again, I go back to some oversight over, are we just going to shoot science projects out of the sky? And I understand the thought process in you know, it was flying at 40,000 feet. That's air traffic. You're having to shut down airspace because it's a threat to civilian aircrafts. But you're right. I mean, if we haven't shot anything over U.S. domestic territory, at least the mainland, in some 65 years, I think we need to hear from the administration. What are we doing and why are we doing it?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it was funny. They were talking about these inclement conditions in Alaska and the Yukon to try to get to these objects and things. I think somebody said on the Senate side it was 55 degrees below zero. And as you know, I'm a Star Wars fan, and it reminded me of a scene in The Empire Strikes Back in Star Wars, where they shot down a probe, and they said it must have had a self-destruct. It didn't hit it that hard, and it was on the planet Hoth, which is the ice planet. And as soon as I was hearing about these inclement conditions up in Alaska and the Yukon, it made me think of Hoth, the ice planet in Star Wars. So be that as it may. But we have another bomb here ticking in the Capitol, don't we, Aisha?
We do. We're still watching this debt ceiling debate, which has not gotten anywhere. And we have some time. We have a couple of months. But tell me, because we had a huge report come out, the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, released this report sort of forecasting, giving us an economic forecast and when they think the Treasury will no longer be able to keep the government functioning. So what did we learn? What kind of information do we glean from that report?
Right. Well, this is going to be, as Bananarama would say, a cruel summer. Sometime over the summer, probably between July and September, is when the CBO says that the U.S. will hit the debt ceiling and then be unable to pay its bills unless Congress, you know, votes to raise or suspend the debt ceiling. Now, that's not unknown. We knew that this was going to be sometime, summertime, et cetera. The Treasury had said that June, they thought that the period would be. The reason this is confusing and the reason why it's hard to pin down a certain date is you don't know how the economy is doing. You don't know how Treasury decides to pay certain bills or delay certain payments. So, you know, there's things coming in and out the door all the time so they can use what they call extraordinary measures to stave this off a little bit. The first and particularly the second quarter of the year, the revenues historically for the federal government go up a lot because it's tax season, people paying their taxes. So, you know, if the revenues and receipts are up, this might delay this some more. And, you know, I had before CBO put this time frame out, somebody who really knows Capitol Hill and knows the budget process to me very well said to me a few weeks ago, said, oh, this will all be worked out, or the true deadline will be the end of July, 1st of August, which is when Congress goes on the August recess, because that's always the crisis time here on Capitol Hill. You've heard me say it before, beware the Ides of August. So maybe this is really an August project. But keep in mind that Treasury, they kind of set the date on this more than CBO and the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. He had said, we'll go by what Treasury says, not by what CBO says. But the really interesting thing that I found in that report, Aisha, that came out the other day, was the amount of debt that is being piled onto the federal books right now that they predicted over the next decade, $20 trillion, which is $3 trillion more than they expected. And the fact that the debt right now is about $31.4 trillion, you're going to graduate to $50 trillion and change in just a couple of years. That is staggering.
Here's my question for you, and that is staggering. Here's my question for you on the politics side of this. Do you think Speaker McCarthy will be able to walk away with something? Something that he can take back at least to that faction, right, that he kind of had to negotiate with during his speakership bid to be able to somehow cut the spending. Do you think he gets something from the administration?
If you look at most times we've dealt with these debt ceiling crises, almost every time they've come away with some sort of a spending agreement, sometimes very modest, but it has happened. And this is where a lot of times, from a political standpoint, one side or the other uses this as an opportunity to secure something. Now, Kevin McCarthy knows it's good politics for him to go in and say, hey, we're just not going to raise the debt ceiling willy-nilly. We're going to get something out of this. We have to have a certain amount of cuts. Now, what he has said publicly doesn't quite match reality. He said, we're not going to touch Social Security and Medicare. And that's about 40% of all federal spending each year right there. Okay, so if you're going to balance the budget, which is what he and other Republicans have said.
You have to touch those two, right.
You have to. I mean, the math doesn't work out. And, you know, the CBO briefing the other day, Phil Swagel, he alluded to that. He said it is just so challenging to do. You know, you would have to cut $7 trillion in spending. Now, you talk about staggering amounts of money. You would wreck the economy. You would wreck the global economy if you were to do that. So there has to be a way that you do this. But what Kevin McCarthy, and this is where I've been very closely watching the code that is spoken both by President Biden and by the Speaker, because the President said, I'm not going to negotiate the debt ceiling. He didn't say, I'm not going to negotiate on some sort of spending agreement. Now, this might put him in hock with some of his more liberal Democratic friends, but maybe if they were to come through with, say, police reform or something like that, then they'd be okay with this. What is absent from that conversation, you know, this is kind of like the dog that didn't bark, if you know this from Sherlock Holmes, they have not talked about Medicaid. Now, Medicaid gets you up into about 65% of all federal spending if you talk to the other. So that's the code that I'm gleaning here. So maybe they work out some sort of an agreement, and Kevin McCarthy is able then to go back to his conference and not provide the votes to lift the debt ceiling with maybe a few or 20 or 30. I mean, who knows what that would look like.
Sure.
But say, we marshaled some sort of an agreement on spending caps, on, you know, the annual appropriations bills. Probably even more importantly is that we have put some of these entitlement programs on a more sound fiscal footing. You know, they said in that report the other day, Aisha, that Social Security would be insolvent, bankrupt in less than 10 years.
I know. And I don't think that many Americans, at least my family and friends, think about that. You know, I don't think that's something that too many people are aware of or thinking about. And that's the conversation that truly both Democrats and Republicans need to come together and sort of find an agreement about, which is what now Senator Rick Scott keeps talking about, because he's trying to fight that messaging war that the White House is waging sort of against him and other Republicans based on his ideas. He's now coming out and saying, look, we have to do something to make sure that we keep these programs around and they don't just sort of dissolve.
Yeah, and that's why he's fighting with Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader. You know, there is no love lost between Mitch McConnell and Rick Scott.
Uh-huh.
And Mitch McConnell, again, at a press conference the other day, came out and tore into Rick Scott and says, that is not the policy. We're not going to, you know, that is not a Republican proposal. We're backed by most Republicans to have this. And let me let you in on a little bit of the stagecraft here, too. The last time that, and this is just kind of how this happens here on Capitol Hill. On every Tuesday, there is the weekly policy lunches. The Democrats go in one room and talk, and the Republicans in the other, and then they come out in the hallway, the Ohio clock quarter, and talk to the press. Well, most weeks, the Republicans come out, and almost every week, and I'm not beating my breast here, but Mitch McConnell happens to take my question first. Maybe it's, I mean, I stand right there next to where he walks out. I've been here a long time. Okay.
You're hard to miss.
But, well, yes. But here's what's interesting. He did not take my question first this week. And he turned to Burgess Everett from Politico, who asked him a question then about Rick Scott. And what's interesting is that some months ago, this was last year, I got a call from Mitch McConnell's office saying, oh, would you know, here's something, you know, that the leader would be very interested in saying if you were mm-hmm. to ask this question. And I told them, this was last year, Aisha, I said, I'm not going to take questions from somebody else and pose them. I said, that's just not how I play ball, you know, and they were a little bit taken aback and everything. And sure enough, at that same press conference that day, there was another reporter, John Bresnahan, who asked the first question about Rick Scott. And so what this shows you is this is Mitch McConnell's office trying to make sure that they get out there and get their point of view across on Rick Scott. So that's some of the stagecraft behind the scenes there. But
I also wondered, you know, and again, we have so much time to play with here, months and months. But I also wondered how much Mitch McConnell will wind up, if he's sort of waiting in the wings here, waiting
yes.
for his moment to come in and sort of like wheel and deal and finally, you know, find a compromise between the White House and you know, the Senate, obviously.
Yes.
In the same way that he did, gosh, how many years ago?
This was in 2011. Negotiating
mm-hmm.
within Vice President Biden.
Yes.
Yeah, he comes in on the white horse, and that's how they did this. So.
Uh-huh.
And so you might be right. And to put a bookend on this here, Aisha, you know what's interesting? I remember a study years ago, and you talk about the entitlement programs and the debt ceiling and the solvency of Social Security here. Years ago, there were people who were in their 30s and 40s. The poll was, do you think you will see and get your Social Security benefits, or is it more likely that you will see a UFO? And the people said that it was more likely that they would see a UFO. So maybe we have a nexus
really?
Of these two stories this week, actually.
Oh, my
yes,
gosh.
Absolutely.
That's actually so funny because that's actually how my dad has been talking to me. We were talking about UFOs and Social Security. My dad's about to retire, so mm-hmm. that Social Security, all of that is on his mind, and he asks me almost every day, what's going on with that on the Hill? And I'm always like, I can tell you more about Chinese spy balloons right now than I can tell you about what's going on with that.
I like it. My dad is always asking me questions if he should, you know, put money in a drawer somewhere or get his firearms ready or something like that. So, but anyway, Aisha, great to talk with you this week. Always a pleasure.
You too. Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
That'll do it for today's Fox News Rundown from Washington. Tomorrow, we take a look at how the deficit impacts you and if the Biden administration has been effective in managing it. Until then, I'm Ryan Schmelz. Thank you for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.